Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to a special cold weather warning version of the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Warm for the moment. Glad to be joined again today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. You seem warm.
I've already got my long underwear ironed and ready to go.
I think if you iron your long underwear, it gets a little scratchy, but I don't know. We're here recording on, you know, late morning on Thursday with the cold weather alerts looming over central Texas, or actually looming over much of the country.
Yeah.
But, you know, big news in Texas.
So, oh, yeah.
As the weather often is. So keep an eye on that. You don't need me to tell you that, but I'll, you know, try to get some public service points.
My brother even had a friend visiting this week, and he was like, are you sure you want to come? And his friend, you know, it's like Austin doesn't really present well in this kind of weather. And
unless you like panicky, freaked out people.
Yeah, panicky, freaked out people, no toilet paper. I'll come next.
I tried to go to the HEB last night to just drop by the pharmacy, and the line at the South Congress HEB, admittedly one of the busiest HEBs, but still out on, you know, took me 20 minutes just to get to the gate and realize, yeah, I'm not.
It's like a joke that's become true. Like people are like, oh, you're picking up your toilet paper and be like, ha, 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 I already did.
Yeah, it was all over. It was all over Reddit.
Yeah.
You know, for what that's
worth.
Hey,
Texas. All right.
So aside from the weather, we have a main focus in mind today to talk a little bit about the kind of issue sets and moods in the respective primaries. You know, last week we talked quite a bit about the general election and polling results.
Specifically, a little bit more.
But, and you know, some of the specific races, but we thought we'd go a little more environmental today. But before we do that, environmental, not mental, let's start with a couple brief notes. There's a few things going on, you know, just worth in our bailiwick. So, first, got up this morning to a new national New York Times Siena College poll, essentially showing, I think, a lot of more of the same for Trump. You know, maybe the thing I noticed was kind of no help from the recent foreign policy focus, or, you know, no real divergence there. Anything stick out on you, to you, in all that?
You know, not really. I mean, I hate to be kind of a bummer. I mean, I think the thing that struck me when I saw the headline, you know, sort of the notion that, you know, he's basically sitting with about a third of the public happy with him, has sort of been the shorthand kind of for my understanding of what the polling has generally been showing, which is, if you're going to say, like, across the wide range of issue areas that have been touched in the last couple of weeks, you know, there's about a quarter to a third of the electorate who's going to be very happy with almost all of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what that poll kind of picks up on a national level, but it's not new news. And then people say, well, then why even do it? But it's also like, yeah, but, you know, one of the things you're going to figure out here is, like, is there a floor? Are we seeing a deviation away from that as the campaign rhetoric shifts and that kind of thing? So that's where these things are valuable. I mean, the main point is that, you know, nothing that's happened in the last few weeks, I mean, this is not surprising, has anything to help those numbers.
Right. And, you know, and I think the other thing I noticed is that, you know, with an allowance for Texas, but even doesn't even take that much of an allowance, really, how similar the national numbers are to Texas.
Yeah, you know, I keep,
certainly the pattern.
You know, let me ask you this question, because I think it's something you think about a lot and maybe even thinking about more than me, but I wonder, and this is not really the point of this conversation, but we'll do it real quick anyway, is, you know, how much do you think of that as like a reflection of, you know, changes in the Texas electorate, which we see going on, but at a very, you know, glacial pace, as those sorts of changes do occur on the one hand, but on the other hand, just the nationalization or the hyper-nationalization of politics in the sense that you don't see that sort of clear, like, oh, this is Texas, here's the country.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, this is something I'm getting ready to give a talk to a group today, and it's going to be one of the hooks, is that thing we've, you know, sort of beat this horse into Alpo probably on the podcast over this issue, but still, you know, how we disentangle national from state. But the, you know, I mean, I think the similarity in these big national patterns and how similar, you know, to Texas is just how dominant the national political environment. And frankly, you know, how dominant Trump is in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And the obverse, how large he looms over in Democratic thinking and the mindset of Democrats. And I just think that's crossing state lines.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll get into this actually pretty soon.
Yeah,
we're going to get to it. I mean, you know, when you say that, I mean, when I was sort of the word that was coming to my head, which I don't mean it as a, you know, in a negative way, but it's like the subservience of Republicans other than Trump to his narrative.
Yeah.
Sort of just ever present in a way that is, you know, it would be hard for you to have a you know, sort of a state level kind of your own version of events and your own focus in most cases, except unless there's some sort of huge disaster or something.
Well, and there's two pieces to that. There's, you know, look, the power of Trump's presence and personality and, you know, the way that he has occupied the field. You know, but also, you know, the fact that, you know, the intermediate levels are interesting here. And as I'm thinking about, maybe this is one of the mechanisms that we're talking about. The fact that also so many state level, you know, not even so many, virtually all state level Republicans in Texas are on board. And they're, you know, there's really very rarely any dissent among Texas political figures in terms of the cues that they are sending from Donald Trump. And so that reinforces the dynamic.
And if you are creating distance and, you know, setting any sort of contrast between yourself and the president as a Republican, you're probably doing it in the process of like leaving office.
Or so. Yeah, right.
Like at this point, it's like part of your exit.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, you look at the people that have maybe kind of raised their heads over the hedge a little bit.
Yeah, they're either not running for reelection.
You know, it's, people like Michael McCall or, you know.
Even McCall has not done it a lot.
You know,
right.
So. The other thing I thought, you know, worth touching on that, you know, I think we both talked to, you know, reporters on and off the record and, you know, it's and something we as we rediscovered this morning that we've been talking about for a very long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that kind of caused some ripples in the political universe and ripples, I mean, just barely broke the surface. But
yeah.
You know, is the release of a campaign poll by the Jasmine Crockett campaign.
Right.
That was in response to an Emerson College NextStar poll. You know, the Emerson College NextStar poll, I think, came out in between
last Friday. Podcast. I think it was really, it was in between. It was late last week.
You know, found Tallarico, I think, slightly ahead of Jasmine Crockett in a trial ballot.
Right.
And then the Crockett campaign then early this week released their own internal polling showing Crockett with, you know, a 6 or 7 point lead, I think, something like that.
I love this, by the way, because I think this is a great example that proves the point.
Well, right. I mean, the proximity of the two things is why we're talking about it. So, yeah, go ahead. And I know this is a point you like to talk about. So we've both talked about it a bit. So go ahead.
Yeah, we'll do this relatively.
It's just worth reiterating.
Yeah, to your point, you know, if you want to take like a little bit more of a longer look at this, you know, we have a piece we wrote back in 2013, and I think it's been updated here or there about sort of the problem with trusting sort of the accounting that comes out of campaign polls.
Yeah.
And the short version of it is this, right? You know, any time that a campaign releases a poll, they only do it for strategic purposes. They only do it in a way to shift or, you know, change the narrative or drive some other strategic consideration like fundraising. Yeah. And the thing to know about this is that, you know, just real quick, look behind the curtain here. Nobody knows. We don't know. They don't know. Nobody knows what the electorate is exactly going to look like and when the primary happens, right? And so what that means is if you're a good campaign pollster, one of the things you're doing is you're creating a bunch of estimates, you know, depending on whether, you know, Hispanic turnout looks like it did in the last primary or the time before, whether it surges and vice versa, and all these little decisions you get to make. And this helps the campaigns make more strategic decisions about resource allocation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Having said that, which of those estimates ends up getting released to the public in an effort to shape coverage is totally up to the campaign.
Right.
What decisions that were made that went into that, why that is getting released, is never really, you know, obviously going to be made transparent. But the one thing that you have to know as a consumer of this is that it is to shift the discussion.
Right.
So the fact that, like, and this is a great example.
And in a specific direction,
right,
always to some degree or another in the interest of the campaign that releases data.
Find one internal campaign poll that has ever been released by a campaign where they say, well, we're down by more than 10. Never happens because they never would, right? And so this is sort of, you know, it's notable that I just want to say right now, I'm not standing up for the veracity of the Emerson poll or their methods or anything else. I think, you know, primary polling is hard. So it's an estimate and there's some sense to it. I think there's some valid criticisms. There's some less valid criticisms. That's not what we're doing here today.
Yeah.
The main point is to note that, you know, we see a poll come out, Tallarico goes ahead, the campaign of the of his opponent comes out and says, no, wait, we have a poll too. And this is right. all just to say, I think everybody needs to like take that all with a grain of salt. What I take from all of it is to say, look, you know, I think what you see here is this is a contest. I mean, I think going into it, there was some, you know, potential suspicion that given Crockett's high name ID, high favorable name ID among Democrats, that maybe she was going to come in and just kind of run over some of the other candidates, including Representative Tallarico. And I think what the polling, even her polling to some extent shows, is it's not going to be that kind of race. It's going to be a little, it's going to be tighter. It's going to be closer. It's going to be more of a contest. And if anything, this is, if all the things you would take from that, that's the thing that I would take from that.
Yeah. And I, you know, we'll, you know, we'll try to remember to link to the 2013 piece. I mean, I went back and looked, reread that mm-hmm. this morning, and it is very specific. So I think, you know, per our earlier discussion about our production schedule, we are probably, you know, the time is ripe for an update of that piece that we wrote now 13 years ago or 12 and a half years ago.
Right.
Which is amazing in and of itself. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. And, you know, I would even add to your, you know, your caveats about the polling. I'm not even saying that the Crockett poll, there's a problem with it.
No.
You know, I would just say two things that I, you know, said to, you know, one of our contacts at KXAN yesterday that, you know, the problem is, you know, or one of the issues here, in addition to the, this is an interested release of information no matter what, is that there, you know, this polling, campaign polling is held to a different standard of disclosure, right? And so there's a lot about that poll that I would like to know that I don't know. And the campaigns historically have been under, you know, have not felt compelled by, you know, the norms of practice, you know, to release that information. There were no crosstabs for this poll.
Yeah.
You can't see the questionnaire. I don't know about question order.
I don't like the underlying demographics.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The underlying, even, and in this poll, even the underlying demographics weren't available. So I, you know, again, I didn't look at that poll and say, oh, this has got to be wrong.
Right.
I mean, after all, it's, you know, this is the period, as we've been saying, where we expect things to move a little in this race as people start spending more money. You know, Tallarico just did another interview, long on a different topic, could almost be on the list. You know, long on theology, short on policy, I thought, frankly, with Ezra Klein for the New York Times. Now, is that going to move the needle in the universe? Not a lot, but it's, you know, it's a good hit for him, part of a what has been a very successful, savvy media strategy.
Yeah.
And then the other piece of this is, you know, and it has to be saying, I, you know, we had a funny exchange with the reporter I talked to yesterday. You know, part of the reason, you know, this is something that's gone on. You know, we wrote this piece almost 13 years ago, could have written it 13 years before that.
Right.
But is the media appetite for this?
Yeah.
Right. And that media appetite, interestingly, I think, and this was actually in the 2013 piece, I was thinking about it yesterday. I mentioned it yesterday to talking to the reporter thinking, oh, yeah, this is part of it. But, you know, something we thought about 12 years ago. But be that as it may.
It's a good idea.
But the disaggregated media environment has made that even, you know, more prevalent. In other words, you know, the difficulty of you know, I mean, look, I think in some world that will never exist and probably shouldn't, we would like to say, hey, the new norm is, you know, reporters don't pay attention to campaign polling. And then, you know, the value, that campaign polling reverts to having mainly internal value rather than having these secondary external benefits where if you get in trouble and you have you're doing polling, you have a pollster on retainer, you can go, hey, let's whip something up to.
Yeah.
And that is that, you know, the combination of, you know, the newsletter, intense political, vertical, you know, environment from the more higher level things to the more, you know, we're just going to report everything somebody tells us because insiders want the information, is not going away and has gotten more pronounced since we wrote that 12 years ago. And so, you know, that's the other piece of this is media appetite. And then it falls on media to contextualize those polls. And, you know, I think once you put a poll like that in a headline, you know, having, you know, a quote from somebody or a little, you know, a sentence added by an editor, you know, in the eighth graph going, oh, and by the way, you know, campaigns released, blah, blah, blah. You know, it doesn't really change what's negative about this.
You know, and a little bit of a side angle to what you're saying, you know, I had a conversation over at KUT earlier this week about earned media. And one of the things, you know, and earned media is essentially, you know, non-paid for media. Now, you paid for
which intersects this pretty clearly.
Yeah, I think it does too. And it's funny, I was actually thinking about it from a slightly, I mean, I totally agree with everything you said about sort of the appetite for, you know, very intense sort of, you know, newsletters and for the people who are focused. But even beyond that, I think, you know, one of the other things about sort of the
social media,
about the fractured media environment is the fact that, you know, it's not necessarily the case that if you get something, you know, on the major networks, like everybody that you want to pay attention is ever going to see it.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that this also does is, you know, I mean, like, I feel like I'm in this world now too, strangely enough, although it's educational, it's like you're in this constant hamster wheel of content creation, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is that when the campaign goes and releases that internal poll, yeah, they're releasing it to the various, you know, traditional outlets, everything else, because, you know, older people still watch the evening news and, you know, they look at the papers and all
morning
that stuff.
News shows.
Yeah. And people who really follow this stuff do. But if you want to start to like hit the other people, well, you know, you're going to cut it up into a, you know, a 20-second, you know, thing for TikTok, or you're going to have a little Instagram thing, reel or whatever. And in some ways, you know, that actually is where there's some more value, especially comes out of earned media now, because in some ways, because everything's so fractured, you can like actually spider it out there a little bit more effectively.
Yeah.
But I think that's also true with something like this, where now it's like, you can say, hey, you know, well, we did our own research and you know what we found?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, this is our own research piece of that is an interesting
and you get to you get to target it out. And again, it's not earned because you're paying for the poll. Often you're paying for placements, you're promoting these ads, you're pushing them to the right people. That's what all the digital advisors are doing. But at the same time, it almost is like an earned media thing where it's like, hey, there's this ambient thing going on that you should know about. By the way, you know, if you heard this, it's not right or
and
whatever.
Instead of paying attention to that, pay attention to this for the next
5 minutes,
seconds.
Right.
Little bit until the next thing comes in. So,
right.
But, you know, you've accomplished the goal there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, as a third thing, I'm tempted to add the finale of Landman Season 3, which I subjected myself to last night as a work assignment.
It's good for
you. We'll let that go, but if you're watching Landman, you know what I'm talking about.
Your commitment to your job is an inspiration to me.
You know, I'll tell you, when I'm watching Landman, it feels that way. But it's an interesting exercise in television, and there is obviously, for those of you that are going, what the is he talking about? I mean, you know, there's a direct connection in that I think Taylor Sheridan, the Landman universe and all of that, you know, helped turn the tide on the film subsidies and that program in Texas. I mean, a lot of these guys were on site in the legislature last session. So I'm not just injecting a little TV criticism in here. Be that as it may, we'll put Landman on the shelf for right now, or Landman, as I call it around the house.
Landman.
We've sort of circled back. We talked last week about the December poll, as I said, broke some things down around issues and around the major races. But I think the good thing to do is, it's occurred to us, I think, is, you know, talk a little bit about what the issue environment is.
Yeah.
In the discrete universes of the primary.
I mean,
I think one of the reasons I wanted to do that, I felt like last week and for the last few weeks, and it's typical of this stage of the cycle, you know, you kind of go back and forth by going, well, here's these issues that are out there.
Right.
Here's these, you know, the races, but, you know, then there's this, we're dabbling in the primary universe and then we're bouncing back to the implications for the general and then back, and the national state thing complicates that. So I thought, let's focus on, you know, the primary issue universe for a little bit.
And also just to, you know, to give us a little bit of grace here. I mean, it is notable that, like, you know, when you think about, I mean, we're looking at kind of our polling and sort of pre-primary polling and all that kind of stuff. And when you think last time in the last primary election about how much state level action was going on, right?
Yeah,
this was after the ESA vote, you know, Abbott was getting involved in the primaries, Paxton was getting, like, everybody was involved in really unique ways that made the state issues, I mean, I want to say more prominent, but they were very prominent, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we, you know, what we kind of, you know, just sort of refresh our memory of that, we kind of came out with is that that manifested last time in a very interesting way. And I'm kind of trying to figure out how that's at work here. It's clearly at work less so, but there's the things going on.
Well, and it was
in terms of the ESAs were a lot of the, and how that, the failure of ESAs in the 23 session and the intense fights over that, Governor Abbott's investment, drove a lot of that intervention, even though that issue was not super salient or prominent in the campaign ads, a point we've made in here a lot.
So
let's talk about where we are now. So let's start with Republicans. So, you know, let's start at a specific place. As everybody knows, we ask these most important problem for the Texas and the country, every poll we do. So if we break down the tabs, what does that look like on the Republican side? What does it tell us, Dr. Blank?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, in December, unsurprisingly, if you listen to the podcast, you know, immigration and border security still remain the most important problem facing the state, according to Republicans. So that was chosen by 30% overall. So that's a plurality, about one in three. And however, as we've discussed, it's not been uncommon. And in fact, it's been really a standard feature of polling over the last decade to regularly find, you know, between 50 and 60% of Republicans saying that immigration or the border is the most important problem facing the state. And I think it's important because if we think back and we're kind of looking back to the polling and think about, you know, we're talking about the overall kind of what's the Republican universe looking right now. And we say, okay, in December of 2025, 30% said immigration or border was the most important problem. We've consistently said that the salience of this issue to Republicans makes it a kind of go-to for the campaigns and the candidates. And we, you know, just in general, when you're marketing something, it's much more effective to basically, you know, refer to things that people are already thinking about. You're trying to get people to think about something they don't care about, aren't thinking about, haven't heard of. That's a lot of work, right? This is why brands spend billions and billions of dollars to establish themselves and they don't throw it away. Same thing here. If people are thinking about immigration at the border, that's a great way to meet them. So again, 30% in December of 2025 going into this election year. Back in February of 2024, so a little bit later, but same time frame, 68% of Republicans said immigration at the border. Back in February 2022, it was 58%. So 10 points less, but still between 58 and 68%. Going back to February 2020, when there was still a COVID overhang, it was 52%. And in February 2018, during Trump's last midterm election, so it's thinking more comparable, taking on immigration more directly, it was still 48%. It was still almost 20 points higher than it is today.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty big shift. So while immigration and border security remain just certainly at the forefront, especially at the state level, you know, what we could say is that Republican attention is significantly more fractured than what we've seen, you know, in the past. In reality, it looks a little bit more like Democrats. Democrats usually split across a bunch of issues.
Right. In its structure, not its content.
No, not its content, but just in the sense that it's split across a lot of different issues.
Right, the lack of consensus.
Right. Yeah. So when we look at, like, the most important problem facing Texas, again, 30% of Republicans said immigration or border security. The next biggest issue, inflation and prices, 23%. So 15% said inflation or prices. 8% said the economy. So that's total. I'm sorry. 23% said inflation, prices, or the economy. Something having to do with an economic issue. And then after that, it kind of drops off. 7% said taxes, 6% said moral decline, kind of goes off. Now, if we look at the most important problem facing the country, 22% of Republicans said either inflation, prices, or the economy, split almost evenly. 17% say immigration or border security, so a little bit less than said the economy. 10% say political corruption or leadership, which was pretty interesting. Now, in case you're wondering right now, Donald Trump's job approval among those Republicans, 74-26. So, like, that they're not talking about him, just in case you're thinking that's the thing. Another 8%.
Presumably, right.
Yeah, it's unlikely. Or if it is, it's a fraction of a fraction.
Well, that's not too far off, you know, where the hard disapproval of Donald Trump is in the mid-single digits.
Yeah, exactly. Right? If you'd say, you know, okay, so 26% of 10% is 2.6%. So that's,
we're getting.
That's pretty small, right? And then 8% of the federal spending or debt, which is, I think, a pretty, you know, common sort of things we would think about, right? And so, you know, overall, I think the first, you know, thing to say is that immigration and the border is still, you know, this primary issue among Republicans, but its salience has receded pretty dramatically. And to the extent it's been, you know, replaced, it hasn't been replaced by anything entirely because it still sits there, but concerned about the economy, prices, all these things that we've been talking about, that honestly, everybody is talking about, are evident there among Republicans, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the, you know, in the common dynamic that we talk about in here all the time, one of the interesting things here is, you know, teasing out, like, you know, this is such an abstract way of thinking about this, but I'll say it anyway. The kind of unmediated, like, people look at something, they have this experience or they have this cognitive set of dispositions and opinions, and they kind of go, yeah, this concerns me.
Yeah.
And then there's all the things we're always talking about, the messaging they're getting that is the kind of coefficient or sort of activates or, you know, suppresses that given partisan filtering.
Right.
Right. And, you know, you look at that most important problem in the U.S. and you look at immigration and border security, and the concern over immigration, I'd have to go back and look, is still double digits in the kind of thing that moves the needle in these MIP at 13%. But the border security is down to 4%.
Right.
And so, you know, as we've said in here before, I mean, I think part of this is there was a period when we combined immigration and border security pretty reflexively.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about this, so I don't want to go on, but now you see a difference. And I think, you know, you have to kind of keep that in mind as we look at this, some of the things we talked about last week, you know, the national focus on immigration enforcement and the polarized responses.
Yeah. And the challenge here, I think, you know, that we're finding, but we're starting to see how it's playing out. Now, I think if we were to go and, let's say right now, just do an open, let's say we, you know, had a poll of just primary voters, you know, if we could do that, if we could do such a thing and be certain, you know, that these are a good representative sample of the primary universe, right? And if we went to Republican primary voters and give them an open-ended question and say, hey, you know, what do you want to hear your state legislative candidate talking about? What do you want to hear? Like, I guarantee you, probably at least 30% and probably more would say something about immigration and the border, just knowing what we've seen in open-ended items, you know, across the lifetime of this poll. And despite this, now the challenge for Republicans, and I think you're starting to see this play out, you were bringing this up this morning on the ride in, is okay, well, border crossings are down.
Yeah.
Okay, one. Two, enforcement is way, way up, right? Yeah. Very visibly so. And any sort of, you know, border concern at this point can't really be attached to the federal government's handling of the issue, because that's Donald Trump's handling of the issue. So then where do you go to raise the specter of this issue? And if, I mean, I've been having various conversations with reporters, but this is where things like Sharia law come up all of a sudden, right? I mean, I think you brought up, you know, an ad that I want to convey because I didn't see it, you know,
right.
You know, that pretty directly takes aim at sort of the large non-white population.
Yeah, it was state Senate, Republican state Senate candidate challenged. We don't have to be coy about this.
No,
Charles Schwertner ad basically saying, you know, making sure that the viewers knew that he was taking up the mantle of, you know, defending Texas from the imposition of Sharia law, essentially.
Right. And this is being talked about, I think, fairly frequently. I mean, I got a couple reporter requests to sort of talk about this a couple of weeks ago, even just sort of this kind of this uptick in this. And I mean, it's sort of an interesting thing because my response, you know, I think is sort of, I think, telling in some ways, which was they were saying, you know, the question was essentially, you know, would Muslim-leaning Republicans, you know, or Muslim Republicans rather, Republican-leaning Muslims, there we go, that's better, you know, would they react negatively to this? And I said, well, look, I, you know, maybe, but the other thing is if you look at the demographics, you know, the Muslims make up, you know, less than probably like 1-3% of Texans max. So we're not talking about a huge population. That's not to say it doesn't matter, but the point is more so the threat of Sharia law remains pretty low here for all kinds of reasons, right? But part of it is this is a way to enter, you know, this sort of space without being critical of the current administration, acknowledging that there's a problem, but still talking about it, right? And we've seen this before, but this is sort of the way that this is kind of being entered in a comfortable way. And part of this is the fact that, you know, if you go and start looking around at sort of the active campaigns on the Republican side, you start looking at their websites and saying, what is in the place of prominence on these websites? And for the most part, the place of prominence on these websites is some nod to the president.
Yeah.
Right? It's a picture, you know, it's a picture with the president. It's
right.
Anything they can do that shows them supporting the president and his agenda.
Well, that sure looks like a nail for me to hit with my hammer.
Well, please do.
Which is just, you know, I mean, that's such an... To me, that is a great illustration of this sorting out, you know, the state level bubbling up from Texas more or less organically and picking things in that field that are reinforced by the national environment.
Right.
Right? I mean, obviously people have made an issue of this in regions of the Texas. We don't have to go into the details right now. So,
well, and they want to get on that, right? I mean, Trump remains wildly popular with Texas Republicans. I think that's sort of, you know, one of the things that you just has to be acknowledged here is that when we look at sort of the top elected statewide Republican officials, you know, Trump's approval among all Republicans is 82%. Amongst conservatives, it's about the same. Amongst the extremely conservative, it's 88%. And amongst the most committed Republicans, people say they're strong Republicans, it's 95%. And Abbott's not far off, but he's about, you know, 4 to 5 points lower than him on all those things. Patrick, Paxton, Cornyn, way below that. Cruz is sort of a little bit maybe in the middle, but closer to the other guys. And so, you know, ultimately he hangs over all this stuff. But then we also know from the polling that, you know, especially among Republicans, his top issue is immigration and border security. And his sort of, you know, much more middling issues are the things we've been talking about, you know, inflation, healthcare, the economy.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to, you know, I mean, I think it's almost important. It's not even a caveat. It's just to make sure that, you know, we don't fall too far into our own rabbit hole here.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason his highest rating on border security, his rating is highest on border security is because they have decisively addressed the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can say, you know, as we've said on here before, yeah, the Biden administration was pivoting before this, and which is true and all that. But there's, you know, absolutely no doubt about the fact that, you know, it's one of the really kind of one of the few areas in which, you know, Donald Trump and incumbent Republicans can point to, and without really much pushback on the narrow thing itself, say, you know, this is addressed.
Right. Right.
Right. So when people say, hey, you know, do you approve of what he's done on border security? I'd be pretty surprised, not just because of the salience, but also because of the policy results.
Right. I mean, because
that it's at the top. I mean, just to be a little bit, it's not even being fair, just to flesh that out.
You know, we had this result from the same poll that we talked about last week, and I'll just flag it one more time, which was we asked about whether the, you know, sort of federal immigration enforcement has, you know, gone too far, been just right, not gone far enough. And this was before the Minnesota protests and a response to that. I want to be clear about that. But overall, the vast majority of Republicans said it's not gone far enough or it's been just right. Like, that's most Republican voters in the state. So if you put that all together, on the one hand, this is an issue we'd expect to be hearing about a lot. We expect to see people tying themselves to the president because, I mean, we've talked about this before. Part of the, even at the state level, and this is sort of the state national thing, part of this is just like, hey, the argument would be, we can't go back. We're addressing this now, but, you know, if there's a change in course, we might not be.
Right.
However, there's a challenge to that. I mean,
yeah, and look, again, within the logic of the Republican primary, all of this, if you're, you know, if you're, you know, you talked about the demographics watching, you know, who are watching, say, you know, what, broadly speaking, broadcast news,
right?
You know, the local news shows, et cetera. You know, the ad buys on that and what we're seeing. So I was, you know, checking the weather this morning on, and I had the local Fox affiliate on Fox 7. And, you know, this is where I saw the Schwertner ad. And you're seeing a lot of the ads and a lot of what we're talking about, you know, is appearing in there. I mean, but the Trump factor is huge. I mean, there was a ad I saw this morning for, and I don't know how big their buy has been for Senator Mays Middleton contest in a very one of the hot, the attorney general race,
right.
You know, seemingly led by Chip, you know, where the front runner seems to be Chip Roy based on both our favorability ratings, some of the early trial ballots.
Yeah.
But, you know, the attack on, you know, the first part of the ad is an attack on Chip Roy and, you know, dinging him for not always agreeing with Trump. And then the cut over to the, you know, if this is technically a contrast ad, big letters, MAGA Mays Middleton.
Yeah.
That kind of tells you what you need to know here.
Yeah.
You know, or tells you something about the way that some of what we're talking about here is resonating in terms of the Trump impact and the way that Trump himself, you know, allegiance to Trump is an issue in and of itself.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things, you know, that sort of ties these together, even from the beginning, is, you know, in that New York Times Siena poll, one of the really great graphics they produced was sort of the way that the coalition has sort of reset. You know, there's a lot of movement in the 2024 presidential election, and sort of the question is, you know, was this? Sort of people were saying, is this a realignment? How durable is it? We talked about how durable this is, and at least in their polling, you know, what they basically showed is a very nice graphic to do. It was essentially the snapback kind of to where things were before.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of that focus is really sort of on the Democrats, but if we just, you know, flip it for a second, think about it, you know, in some ways, the other way to look at this is, you know, you come into this election cycle, and especially this Republican primary, and I think the question would be, so is the Republican primary electorate significantly different from what we've seen in the past? Has it expanded dramatically? Is it likely to expand dramatically and look very different than what we've seen in such a way that would impact the issue environment on the ground here? And it seems like the answer is probably not, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, the you know, the issue of expanding the electorate is a general election play.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, so we will see, you know, it's an old question about the ability to pivot and, you know, but I think the point that the composition of the assumptions about the composition of the electorate.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, it just occurred to me, and you know, just it's just a, whatever, an aside, but I was joking about the, you know, I injected the weather in the intro, but actually there are going to be a lot more people watching local news and local weather in the next week.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, these ad buys are actually going to wind up with bigger audiences.
Now, I do want to say, I don't think that Republicans are ignoring the economy or the affordability issue. But what you're seeing, I think, at the state level is a real focus, again, on attacking the property tax system writ large in various ways, whether it's the appraisal process, whether it's, you know, sort of, you know, property owners' rights, whether it's, you know, whatever.
Just you know, just reminding people how big their tax bills are.
Yeah, which, you know, I mean, again, it's like... It's just problem.
You have something, you know.
Yeah, it's something.
All right. So, how about the Democrats? What does the data tell us about where the Democrats are issue wise? We've already kind of had a teaser in terms of the traditional spread among Democrats, although even that looks a little different now.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats are a lot more, you know, congealed in some ways in their focus than they usually are. I mean, usually the Democratic focus is really all over the place. And here you can say it's really like two issues. I mean, okay. So overall, you know, 30% of Democrats say that political corruption or leadership is the number one issue facing the state. 26% say it's the number one issue facing the country. Those are both pluralities. So to the extent you hear Democrats talking about Donald Trump, talking about Greg Abbott, that is, you know, a big part of the Democratic electorate right now. You know, if we look at disapproval levels, you know, for statewide leaders among Democrats, you know, 93% disapprove of Trump, 85% of Abbott, 87% of Cruz, he's special, and then 74% for Patrick, 75% for Paxton, and 72% for Cornyn. So, like, this is... easy. You know, Democrats know these guys. They know who's up for election. They know they don't like them or the party. So it makes sense. Now, at the same time, Democrats are equally...
I would also add to that, you know, with Paxton just in play, you know, the kind of corruption leadership piece gets a little bit of a shot in the arm.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, and I think, you know, amplified by the Trump thing.
Yeah, and it is important to note also in all of this for, you know, I mean, I don't want to, I'm not trying to pivot, but, you know, for why Democrats are happy to be here is because, you know, 63% of independents in Texas in September had disapproved of the job Trump is doing, right? And a plurality, almost a majority disapproved of the leadership of statewide leaders, which in and of themselves, not problematic, but necessary for Democrats. Now, at the same time, you know, the Democratic voters are equally focused on the economy and inflation. So 32% say it's the number one issue facing the U.S. 22% say the same thing about the state. And I think if you look at the website of most of the visible Democratic candidates, affordability is at or near the top of most of them. I mean, the real question is some sense of like, where is the criticism of Trump and Abbott go relative to affordability? And I think that's part of them. And really right there, I mean, you're seeing a lot of the questions on the Democratic side in terms of like, how much are you leaning to sort of the fighting approach and being, you know, sort of the pushback, the tip of the spear, whatever, versus sort of like, you know, I would say in some ways trying to mobilize a certain amount of public discontent with the economy in a more, you know, traditional way, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the obvious play is you attempt to tie those things together. But as we've said in here, you know, the formula for that is a little more complicated than it looks.
I think.
Now, I think it's not that it's not as complicated in the primary, although it's still there. You know, I mean, you know, as we compare these two, and I don't want to move on entirely from the Democrats yet,
but
as we compare this two, we do see something fairly consistent, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, Trump is Trump and Republican leadership and partisanship most epitomized by Trump, driving, you know, big drivers in both of these primaries.
Right.
And obviously in the opposite ways or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, the economy also very front and center, you know, competing with immigration on the Republican side. But I'm curious if you make much of, you know, the different emphasis on economic issues that we saw in the concerns between the two parties. Because it's interesting. I mean, the extent is different.
Yeah.
And that the concern is, you know, as we were saying last week, both, you know, partisans in both parties are pretty concerned about the economy. So we made a big deal out of healthcare. It's a good example.
Right.
It's a little too exceptional because it's the highest.
Yeah.
But, you know, 83% of Democrats are very concerned about the cost of healthcare, but also 56% of Republicans.
Yeah.
Now, that gap is present, you know, 25-30 point gap in the level of intense concern, you know, with Democrats more concerned than Republicans. But I don't know if I can make very much of the order. You know, in terms of the, you know, the kind of issue set that Democrats might be talking about, you know, the top three areas of concern among Democrats are cost of health care, rank ordered, cost of health care, price of food and consumer goods, tariff policy followed, tariff policy and cost of housing are, you know, tariff policy 71, cost of housing 69, call it the same.
Yeah, right.
Right. The rank order among Republicans is pretty similar in that cost of health care, price of consumer goods are the top two, as it is with Democrats. But then the national debt and the cost of housing are the next two at about the same in the 40 range of concern. So there is a slightly different twist, but not completely different.
Yeah, you know.
And I don't, you know, if you're Republicans in a primary, those numbers are in a intermediate range that I think you can't ignore them, but you can't be confident in leaning on them too hard either.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I had sort of a first gut reaction to what you were saying, and then I sort of had a second wave reaction to what you were saying. You know, my first wave reaction is sort of like, well, I mean, one, the intensity thing, I think, is sort of, you know, you could probably explain a lot of that with the nature of partisanship
and who's in control,
because we see that all the time. And so, you know, but the fact that it's still there is actually what's the, you know,
that's what's tricky,
what's tricky and interesting. I think, you know, we run up into, and even in the nature of where the concerns lie, I think we run up into where some of the pitfalls are for both parties, right? But but it's based on something which I'll get to in the second wave of this, right? Which is to say, you know, I think if everybody agrees, let's just say broadly, that like costs are a problem, you know?
You mean everybody kind of across party lines?
Across party lines.
Everybody's
sort of like, hey, this is an issue. I think it's safe to assume that based on, you know, the history and, you know, the ideological underpinnings of the party, the Democratic response to them, the answer to that would be different than the Republican response, right? I mean, the Republican response very easily to something like healthcare, there'd be a very traditional response would be like, yeah, the problem is that, you know, I'm just making up the argument, but I could see this being an argument. The problem is, you know, they've been doing these enhanced subsidies for so long, it's actually driven up like the cost, and we just need to not be involved in this.
Yeah.
If the government wasn't such a big player throwing its weight around, actually, this could be cheaper.
But that's not what's going on.
That's not what's going on, right? You know, for the Democrats, you know, they're sort of in a, you know, again, a different kind of position because, you know, they're leaderless, which is has its own challenges, but it is like, oh, so how much more government do you want? That would be the traditional sort of Democratic response to some of these things. You know, what can we do, you know, proactively to involve ourselves in the economy, your economic decision making, whatever, to respond to your concern, right? Now, on the one hand, so that's my first reaction to say, they're very different responses to the problem. They have very different expectations, right? But then my second wave response to that is to say, well, yes, traditionally that would be where the parties are. But the challenge is, you know, is that where the parties are in the electorate's minds right now?
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that, you know, when Trump was running in 2024 on making, you know, tips tax-free, I mean, that's a very, you know, kind of, that could have been a Democratic proposal, right? He's not saying let's raise the minimum wage, right?
Yeah.
And so, and then for Democrats, the flip side is, you know, and I think they're having a real conversation right now, you know, maybe not so much in Texas as much as we could have seen. But there's still a broader conversation going on about, you know, so how, you know, very simply understood, quote unquote, liberal is the Democratic Party right now?
Yeah.
You know, is this the party of Mamdani? Is that what we're thinking about? Like over here, you know, is that, and there's a real conversation, is that the path forward? You know, we've got Representative Tallarico painting a pretty different path over here. You know, I mean, we're thinking about the Democrats in Texas who seem to be, you know, most on the rise. They're not really one type of person or one type of candidate or one type of ideology per se.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's reflective of, I mean, that's another thing. It's reflective of, again, a combination of those divisions. You know, you use the national examples, you know, Mamdani, et cetera.
Yeah. But I think here about Greg Kassar, I think
about, you know, when I look at these and I think about what differentiates them, I think that the thing that sticks out to me is one of the biggest gaps is on tariff policy.
Yeah.
Where 71% of Democrats are very concerned, 17% of Republicans are very concerned. And, you know, I don't think that those differences are the results of very deeply seated, thought out economic policy and economic analysis about the historic and possible impact of tariffs, right? Yeah. In other words, Democrats have succeeded in making tariffs an issue.
Right.
And tying tariffs to rising prices. Now, Democrats have a little bit of problem with that in that so far, the overall impact on rising prices has not been acute as many people, including myself, expected.
Yeah.
Now, part of that is, you know, that even though tariffs are something that the president talks about, they have threatened and implemented and moved it around a lot in a way that clouds the issue, but also has probably reduced the likely impact had he just done what he said he was going to do. And that's hard to say. But at the points when he has loudly thundered, we're raising these tariffs through the roof, he's not followed through on most of those.
Yeah, you know.
Right. And so there's been a big discussion going on in the business and economic community about just what is going on with here and what other factors in terms of rising prices might be dampening down what impact there is on prices, and that the impact has been lower than it might have been had the policy been implemented at the level as advertised.
Look, you know, I mean, I think this is like maybe like a sort of half-cocked theory of public opinion right here on this space, but I think it's probably right. I'm just going to say that because I want to. You know, I think what we find is that people's reflections of their own felt economic experiences are pretty durable and pretty, you know, pretty good reflection of the environment that people are in, right? So if you feel like, you know, your groceries cost more and your gas costs more, that's not likely, like someone's not going to tell you that's not true. And you're going to say, well, I guess that's not true, right?
Right.
But when it gets to pretty much any other kind of economic policy, it's too abstract.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right.
You know, I mean, and on multiple dimensions. I mean, it's too abstract. First of all, like, I mean, if you think about this, we say like, hey, what's a tariff? Like, think about where this all started. And there's a whole question like, do people even know what tariffs are? And now we're thinking about people having, you know, these complicated views to the long-term impacts of various tariff regimes that are being threatened and maybe implemented. Yeah. Maybe not. And honestly, that's not reasonable. I'd also say it's not reasonable, and this is important, I was just thinking about this, to expect people to have really deeply held understandings of like, you know, Fed policy. Fed rates and who's the Fed chair and why people care about that or not. That's very, very esoteric information for most people. And that's why I think those sorts of attitudes are much more likely to be influenced by the partisan signals, right? Because absent knowing anything else, right? I'm just saying a different way. Absent knowing anything else, if Trump says tariffs are good and you don't really understand what tariffs are, you know, but all the Democrats are saying tariffs are bad and you don't really understand what tariffs are, that's pretty much kind of conditioned most of what you think about. And I think it's the same thing with some of this other stuff. But that's why I would caution people, you know, and we're sort of talking about this. I think Natalie Jackson is a really well-known pollster who writes a Substack, was kind of sort of pointing out the fact that to pollsters, you know, during the Trump era and the first time and again, voters can't be expected to be paying attention to every single thing that happens every week. Certainly the breadth of it, let alone the depth of it. And this stuff in particular, even though it's been around for like, this stuff is always going on, you know, Fed policy and economic monetary policy. You know, we teach a government class. Like, this is like deep, tough stuff to explain to like college educated students. Most people are not paying attention to this. So if, you know, Trump says the Fed chair is corrupt and I need him changed, that's going to be the main signal that people are receiving. But you don't want to forget about the actual felt experience is probably the bigger driver for most people.
Well, and that's the thing about the tariff policy issue, I think, is that we've seen, I think, over time, the Republican attitudes about tariff policy fall more in line with the Trump position from when we first started asking, I don't know, a year. It's the very first time we asked, probably in the first term. But I mean, I think what's interesting about what you're saying is like the interaction between between two things. One is your, you know, lived experience.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that is keeping the prices,
right,
items, concerns high. And how you connect those experiences to these more abstract issues. And that's where the intervention of partisanship is really, you know, because, you know, if you ask, you know, and we know because we've asked, and I have the data right in front of me, but, you know, when we ask Democrats if they think tariffs are driving prices up, essentially, they say yes.
Right.
Right. Now, as the increases in prices have slowed and inflation has slowed, and that experience is getting, you know, less acute for some people, Republicans are going to fill that gap
Yeah.
With the stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, it's
partisanship, et cetera. And it's this interesting mixture in this instance with, and tariffs are kind of a very specific idea. Because, you know, look at the other items on that list. What is your lived experience of the national debt?
Nothing. That's politics. Right. That's ideology. That's
I mean, and I'm not saying that, yeah. You know, when it comes to, well, people do feel it.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, eight levels down removed right. from the thing itself. But tariffs were connected very directly in the public discourse mm-hmm. to prices.
Yeah.
And frankly, including Donald Trump, who said that in the long term, you know, his initial thing was it would make things cheaper too. Now he had to walk that back, which right. is fine. He doesn't pay any prices for that, a price for that. So why would he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. So I think that's that kind of interaction is an interesting piece of this. And I think you're really onto something with the abstraction and where the room for the partisan influence on things that you don't have, that are complicated and you don't have a lot of knowledge or opinion about, what are the conditions that affect the aperture of that opening, put it that, you well, know, the aperture.
Well, I like how, I mean, just, and this is not really useful, I'm just adding this and just sort of move on, but it's like, you know, it's sort of when, you know, when prices were going up under Biden and Republicans were saying it was Biden's fault and you had all these sort of Democratic leads saying, no, there's global supply chains and there's all these things and then, you know, all these different factors. It's really much more complicated than that. It's not one person.
Yeah.
And then you flip the partisanship and then they're like, no, it's that person. It's that policy.
Right.
That's what it is.
And again, you know, all you have to do is look at our assessment of the national economy and
right.
draw lines at presidential elections and watch them cross over.
Right. Exactly.
You know, at the most general level.
Right.
So, okay, I mean, I think we got something out of this.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of, you know, you're going to some more of the mechanisms for why you're going to expect to hear more about the economy in one primary than the other.
Yeah.
Even though they're all levels of concern, and certainly how you hear about it is going to be different.
So, right.
You know, I think with that, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, for sure.
Stay warm.
I'll try.
Thanks again, as always, to our excellent production team and Liberal Arts Development Studio here at UT Austin, getting us set up. Thanks to all of you for listening. Be sure to go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu, especially after this podcast. Yeah. A lot of data. If you're listening to this on just one of the platforms, if you just go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu, there'll be a link on the front page pretty quickly to this. And you'll be able to look at the data as you go, so that might be helpful. But again, thanks to you for listening. If you're in a part of the country that it's going to start getting real cold and a little threatening out there the next couple of days, stay warm, take care of yourself, you know, follow the good advice of the general people out there saying to giving you safety advice. And we will see you next week on another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.